KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
You know, austerity is like crash dieting. And pure stimulus is like, you know, it's like sugary sodas. You need that path in between. And so what we need right now, particularly in Europe, is we need more reform and less austerity.
Hornus alternifolia. Whoa, plant name is telling you what it is. Alternate leaves. And the other one is Cornus controversa, which is, I always say, it's because it's controversial.
Even within the IRS, there isn't a lot of clarity about what specifically they're asking for. And the gentleman that I spoke with was very nice and as helpful as he could be. And he and I walked through it and sort of figured out what I needed to fill in. But, his guess was sort of as good as mine.
This hour on Weekday, we're going to talk about third world lessons for first world economies with economist Peter Blair Henry. We're also going to talk about gardening. You heard Marty Wingate there. But we're going to start talking about, as you heard, the questions that people may have for the IRS if the tax rules change for same-sex couples. Same-sex couples in Washington State may have a problem at tax time. The state recognizes their union. The IRS doesn't see them as married. That's part of the Defense of Marriage Act. It's Clinton-era law that says marriage can only be between one man and one woman. Next week, the Supreme Court will hear a case that may end, maybe the end of that litigation. Actually, it may be within this week, too, right? Carolyn Adolph, our reporter here at KUOW, has been talking to people about this Supreme Court hearing and what it may mean to them. It's good to see you.
Hey, good to see you.
So what happens if there is a same-sex couple filing their taxes, if they have a union that the IRS doesn't recognize?
Well, it means they can't file married filing jointly. But if only it ended there, what happens is that the IRS acknowledges that some sort of domestic partnership is underway, and so it forces people into what's called a community property arrangement. That's where each person in the couple cleaves their taxes in half and gives it to the other. And it totally changes around their tax brackets.
Oh, man, that sounds hard.
Well, it is. It's horrible. And for people who are trying to calculate this, it's incidentally, but the fact that they can't file jointly means that they don't benefit from a lot of the tax shelters that married people often get. If it works out for them, they'll take some benefits from that.
Which was part of the argument that was made by the supporters of the initiative.
Yes, but they can't get that from Washington. We don't have taxes here, not with income taxes.
Yeah.
So filing community property is usually confusing enough to drive same-sex couples to a tax specialist, and the ones they need are as rare as hen's teeth and not cheap.
Huh.
Not at all. So Beth Gappert is one of the rare birds who does her taxes herself. And she did it last year, again this year. She says it actually changes year over year. So here she is with a great sheaf of paper at her kitchen table doing taxes with me.
Last year, I understood what they were asking. I could fill it out. I understood. This year, it's different. And it's different enough that I ended up calling the IRS. I went through everything on their website, read through all the forms, read through all their publications about this specific form. And the guy that I spoke with in the IRS said, we haven't gotten a lot of clarity about how you should fill this form out either. So even within the IRS, there isn't a lot of clarity about what specifically they're asking for. And the gentleman that I spoke with was very nice and as helpful as he could be. And he and I walked through it and sort of figured out what I needed to fill in. But, his guess was sort of as good as mine.
Do Beth and her partner pay more income taxes than they would if they were married?
She actually hasn't found the time to plod through a married filing jointly. She thinks it's not bad. But there is a catch for her. She pays taxes on the health insurance benefits that she offers to her spouse. And she pays about $180 extra a month in tax for this, about $2,000 a year. So this, it really bothers her, but it's not just about the money.
If we were married and the federal government recognized our marriage, I would not have to pay tax on that. Married couples don't have to pay tax on the value of their spouse's health insurance through their employer. So it makes me really frustrated. It makes me angry.
You hear it in her voice that she's there's a catch there, because it really isn't about the $180 a month. There's something else.
Well, I mean, my wife gets a benefit, right? I mean, I would be angry if you're sharing this life, you're sharing this, and then at the same time, you have to cleave these ideas out, as you say, these benefits out.
Well, yes, exactly.
So what else? We know they have this problem. It would be a problem for us, my wife and I. What problems do they have as a couple?
Well, I found one case where it costs enough to undo the domestic partnership, potentially.
Really?
I didn't even have to look very far. You know, I've got this source network, and we've got about 24 sources in the KUOW Public Insight Network on this subject. And there was Carol Lissance. Carol and her partner have been together for decades, and they decided they wanted the domestic partner card so they wouldn't have trouble in the hospital. So they did it, and then the next year, this community property thing, you know, started up, and now they pay $5,000-$6,000 a year more in taxes than they did previously.
Even though they were living together?
Yes. So, you know, marriage is out of the question. Carol wants out. They're going to stay together, but they want to dissolve the domestic partnership.
So why would she do that? She could just get married right now, right?
Well, I mean, she could, but she feels like she doesn't have the time.
I'm getting older. I'm 70. I don't want to wait for another few years until this gets resolved or doesn't get resolved. I'd just as soon not have to pay that extra money every year.
It's only June where we might find something out. So why not wait at least until then?
I can do that, except that it's my understanding that it may take years for this to actually change in terms of the IRS.
Carolyn Adolph is here talking about some of the reporting she's doing on the potential changes that might take place as the Supreme Court takes up the Defense of Marriage Act, changes that might take place for people who are dealing with their taxes. So she doesn't want to wait until June. Tell us about that case.
Okay, so same-sex couples can't use their marriage to protect themselves from taxes. In U.S. versus Windsor, the issue's inheritance. Edith Windsor and her wife Thea married in 2007. 2 years later, Thea died. And Edith Windsor had to pay $360,000 in federal death taxes on the inheritance, which she wouldn't have had to pay if she were male. So Edith Windsor is arguing that she's being denied equal protection under the law, which is sort of the same case that Beth Gappert makes when she says that the tax system is not offering her protection about the health insurance issue.
Now I look forward to hearing the questions that the Supreme Court comes up with. What are the options for the court?
Of course, it can do nothing. DOMA will still stand, or it could go all the way, which means it would toss out DOMA and it would demand that every state in the union recognize same-sex marriage. Neither seems particularly likely. I've never found anybody that optimistic. But I did speak to Peter Nicholas, who's a professor of law at UW. He says if the court decides to rule on the merits, the ruling might go something like this.
There is a middle ground where they could decide that the Defense of Marriage Act does not even satisfy what they refer to as rationality review, that it is merely irrational to treat same-sex couples differently in this particular way. And that would allow the court to strike down the Defense of Marriage Act without necessarily concluding that every state has to let same-sex couples marry. And if I were betting money on it, if the court decides to reach the merits, I think that's as far as they go.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
All right, so the Supreme Court decides in June, then the IRS has to react. How long does that take?
It's funny. Peter Nicholas says, well, DOMA's practically one line. It just says, where you see marriage, read it this way. But the problem is, how long will the IRS take to chug out the tax guidance? And that's that God is in the details thing. Who knows?
He couldn't say how long it's going to take?
No.
What does that mean for couples who might be considering filing? Can they file late? Can they hold off?
Well, I mean, of course you can file late. You know, I talked to Carol Lissance's tax accountant, and she's done the numbers both ways, and she knows that some of her clients would definitely do better if they could file jointly. So she's ready to roll the dice. If something happens in June and people decide to act fast, then she'll definitely you know, she'll file for an extension in mid-April and wait and then see which particular form she'll put in for them. And she might even file for retroactivity.
What's that?
Well, when you actually say, hey, I've been a domestic partner since 2010 or 2009. I want to claw back in time and retroactively file married.
Oh, it might. So some people can go way back.
Well, let's see. I mean, her hope springs eternal that she might be able to do this for her clients. Let's see if she can.
Carolyn Adolph is the reporter here at KUOW. That was great. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
KUOW 1015, a look at the power of emerging economies in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Sodo Hydro, specializing in indoor and outdoor gardening supplies and hydroponics, featuring grow lights, General Organics, Sunshine Mix, and more. Coming soon, Baker Creek Seeds, located south of the stadiums. Product information at sodohydro.com.
44 degrees, mostly cloudy, with rain expected this afternoon. So, yeah, it's springtime in Seattle. There's clouds, there's rain, there's a little sun from time to time. We might even get some thunder tomorrow afternoon. What does it all mean for your garden? We'll find out in about 35 minutes. That's more like 25 minutes.
Emerging economies around the world made up almost 40% of world gross domestic product in 2010. That's twice the share from 1990. These economies are also home to 80% of the human population. And today, a quarter of Fortune 500 firms come from these emerging markets. So how far can this growth carry these nations out of poverty, onto strong financial footing, economic footing? And since they're so successful, what can the developed economies learn from the developing countries? Peter Buller-Henry is Dean of New York University's Stern School of Business. He's author of Turnaround, Third World Lessons for First World Growth. Nice to meet you. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Tell me something. Who's Miss Mama?
Miss Mama is, or was, I don't know whether Miss Mama is still alive, a figure in the neighborhood where my grandmother lived when I was a kid. And Miss Mom was a woman who would frequently come to the gate when I was a kid with my grandmother. And she would beg for food. And my grandmother always fed her. And it just sort of struck me at a very early age that poverty was all around me. And that got me interested in economics very early on in life.
You also say there's a difference in charity and a decent economic opportunity.
Absolutely. So my grandmother gave Miss Mom a charity, which was the right thing to do for a woman in her 80s to do, being my grandmother. But it struck me that if we really want to help people in poverty, giving them, teaching them how to fish, as it were, is a better way of doing that.
You, isn't that what aid agencies are trying to do? And even more to the fact, isn't that what something like the IMF would argue they're doing when they go into developing nations and offer them ideas for improving their economies?
Well, one of the tricky things we face right now is there are different points of view about how best to help the poor. And one of the reasons I wrote Turnaround is I wanted to try to sift through, if you will, a lot of sort of kind of warring ideology. And I'm very much of the view, and more importantly, the data are of the view, if you actually look at the facts, that it doesn't need to be either or. It's an and proposition. So we need disciplined policies that the IMF has been trying to encourage. And actually, the IMF has a lot of lessons to learn, I think, from going back and looking at their history in the developing world. But aid also has a role to play. I think it's a more modest role than we've thought in the past. But also, very importantly, a lot of the work which says that aid has been very ineffective at creating economic growth has ignored the fact that aid was never really designed to promote economic growth in a lot of circumstances. So we shouldn't be surprised that it hasn't promoted growth, particularly I'm thinking now of African countries during the height of the Cold War.
But isn't aid designed to lay foundations by which economies or countries, regions can grow?
Well, I think that's the key point. So the correct role of aid is not to think about aid as a means to promote economic growth immediately, but how do you create a foundation for healthier populations, right? So and that's really the key thing.
Tell me about the difference between Barbados and Jamaica.
Yeah. So here you have two countries that started off life as former British colonies. And according to a lot of the work that's been done in economics, post-independence, they should have both grown very, very strongly because the economics research tells us that the key to life, in some sense, is being colonized by the British. That was that was the work that was done by some economists at Harvard and MIT.
How's that working out today? Are they still arguing that?
Well, there's a book called Why Nations Fail by Daron Acemoglu and Jim Robinson, which pushes this line of argument very hard. And there's a lot of truth in the fact that institutions matter. The institutions you inherit matters. But Jamaica and Barbados struck me because these are countries that basically inherited those institutions that Robinson and Johnson say really matter, and Acemoglu, but they diverged. And the reason they diverged is because economies, countries have agency. Barbados made tough choices, clear choices about how to maintain free trade, maintain small deficits, and the country flourished. Jamaica, under Michael Manley, had great aspirations for the people, but didn't harness the power of the market, and the country suffered.
In Barbados, well, the oil shock, Barbados made the decision of sitting everybody around the table and asking everybody to take a haircut, including workers in government taking a pay cut. Why was that necessary? Maybe why was that a good idea?
So I think the critical thing in Barbados, you're talking about their crisis in the early 1990s. They were on the bridge on the brink of financial collapse. And they realized that if they didn't do something to bring costs down and become more competitive, they were going to run out of foreign exchange reserves. And in most situations like that, the IMF comes in and tells countries, oh, you need to devalue your currency. And in Barbados, they said, no, we don't want to do that because that's going to undermine trust in our society because people have come to rely on a fixed exchange rate, and it's going to create inflation. So instead, we're going to get everybody at the table, and we're going to get the private sector, the unions, and the government together. And they're able to do that and come to a social compromise.
Why didn't that hurt the poor?
Well, it certainly hurt workers. Workers took a 9% wage cut.
Wow.
But and this is a key thing. The reason why it was good for the very poor is because if you devalue the currency, that raises the cost of living for people who need to do everything from buy fuel to light their lamps or bus fare. And so the workers shared a lot of the pain. The employers agreed to, in the future, give workers wage increases based on productivity gains. So there was an agreement to share future prosperity. And that is what allowed the country to get out of the crisis.
That was the key, right, that the employers came to the table as well.
Absolutely. All three
private
parties
sector
had to be there. Absolutely. And I think the other critical lesson about Barbados was the clarity with which the prime minister, Erskine Sandiford, undertook these negotiations. Because he, as a result of his his brave move, he and his party were kicked out of power for 14 years. And when asked in retrospect, would he do it again? He said, well, the price that I paid was a small price to save the country.
All right. So first of all, because this is all about, as you write, third world lessons for first world growth. First of all, what did Jamaica do? What was their crisis and how did they proceed?
So Jamaica faced a critical decision point roughly 20 years earlier in the early 1970s. Jamaica was faced with a similar oil shock, this time the oil shock of the early 1970s. And the prime minister at that time, Michael Manley, had to make a decision. He had big plans to increase spending, to spend on a number of social programs. And those programs were sort of well-intentioned, but they were expensive. And so the question is that he faced was, well, do I cut back on my ambitions to recognize the changing circumstances, or do I just plow forward? He decided to plow forward, and that was the beginning of an unraveling of the country's economic situation.
How were they when they got hit in the 90s by the same shock that hit Barbados?
Well, unfortunately, Jamaica at that point was already in a pretty difficult situation. And so Jamaica, unfortunately, to this day, continues to muddle through.
And Barbados has remained stronger.
Barbados remains stronger.
So Peter Blair Henry has written Third World Lessons for First World Growth. He's the dean of New York University's Stern School of Business. All right, now I'm just going to jump ahead to where Cyprus is today and where the EU in general is, and then we're going to come to the U.S. here. Aren't some of the – well, let's start with Cyprus. What's happening in Cyprus is the government is saying to all its workers, basically, and it's saying to all its savers And so, again, it's not one size fits all, so explain this to me. Saying to its savers, you're going to help us pay for the problem we're in. Is that a good plan? Is that something that makes global economic sense?
Well, before we see whether it's good or bad, let's look at the key thing here is process. So one of the key lessons, one of the key third world lessons for first world growth is it's essential for citizens to trust their governments. So in this, in the case of Barbados, there was a negotiation at the table about what the options were. The way this plan has come down in Cyprus has been largely top-down and looks very close to something which approximates confiscation of assets, which is not the way to build trust. And we're seeing the ramifications of that in the market.
So what would you say about what's happened in Greece then? Similar actions? Similar lack of trust?
I think if you look at what's happening, I do think there's a real lack of trust. Citizens taking to the streets. But it's also important to say, in the case of Barbados, citizens did take to the streets. But because there was, at that beginning point, a sense of cohesion, a sense that the government was really trying to reach across the table, so to speak, the center was able to hold. And I think also very importantly, and this is one of the other key lessons of the book, discipline doesn't mean taking extreme measures. Discipline means figuring out what's going to be good for the country in the long run. And right now in Europe, whether you're talking about Greece or Cyprus, there is the imposition of a definition of discipline I think is erroneous. It's sort of a German-driven definition, which is we must have fiscal austerity. We must have extreme cuts. And really there needs to be more of an emphasis on reform and less of an emphasis on austerity.
So longer term.
Exactly.
Well, then you anticipated where I was going. So now we come to America, where we are in the same crisis. What are the lessons? What are the smart actions that you saw in covering the third world countries that we could be applying here?
I think a key lesson for the United States comes from a small South American country called Chile. So contrast the United States in 2001. We have a record fiscal surplus in that year, $236 billion. What do we do with that fiscal surplus? We decide to give it back in the form of tax cuts. When economics tells us that we should be saving fiscal surpluses for a rainy day, the story of the ant and the grasshopper. So United States is the grasshopper, Chile is the ant, because in Chile, in 2008, the country is running a huge fiscal surplus because of booming copper prices. The finance minister of Chile faces incredible pressure from the population. He sees himself burned in effigy in the streets because everyone from the students to the workers are saying, give us the money back in the form of various forms of benefits. And he says, no, this money is for a rainy day. And when the financial crisis hits in Chile, they have a cushion. They are able to institute a $4 billion tax cut in order to cushion the blow of the financial crisis. That's the definition of discipline for me.
When you looked at who was writing about this, you write a little bit about what you say and criticizing what's happening. On the left side of the ring, the cynics, mm-hmm. and among those cynics is our good friend Joseph Stiglitz. Is Stiglitz, his own Pulitzer Prize, his own Nobel Prize, rather, what does Stiglitz say about, what are the lessons you see him drawing that are erroneous?
So I think there's a false dichotomy which says, or a view that says the so-called Washington Consensus, the set of economic reforms that were proposed en masse by former Secretary of the Treasury James A. Baker III in 1985, that agenda failed. I think that's rough. I think, you know, without putting words in Joe Stiglitz's mouth, I think in his writings, he's largely said that the Washington Consensus was a failure.
And this was all stemming from what had happened in Mexico and a crisis there and how the world should react.
Yes, and also the Asian crisis, I think, to a large extent. And what I do in this book is to step back and say, look, let's look at this systematically. Let's look at the Washington Consensus not as an entire package, but really the intent with which this was put forward is to say, here are a list of market-friendly policies from which countries can actually construct discipline, and the definition of discipline that I gave earlier, long-term value-creating strategies that are going to be good for the country given their local political constraints. And when countries do that, do people think on average that this is actually going to create value for the country? And so so rather than getting into sort of the ideological realm, let's get into the factual realm of what actually happens when countries implement certain kinds of policy changes. And the The thing that I do in this book, which I think is which is different, is actually let's not look at what Joe Stiglitz says about whether this is good for these economies. Let's not look at what someone on the right says. Let's look at how stock markets in these countries respond when governments implement policy.
Yeah, I was surprised you use stock markets. Everybody says, look at our stock market today. Would we think, if we looked at our stock market today, we'd think, oh, government's doing good with its policies.
Well, there are a lot of reasons why the stock market is up currently, but I think people have also, I think, misinterpreted the stock market. People are talking about a new stock market being a new all-time high, and that's not true once you adjust for inflation. If you go back and look at the history of these countries, these third world countries, when they implement big policy changes, for instance, take Brazil in the early 1990s. When Brazil finally, under the leadership of Fernando Henrique Cardoso, implements the Real program to get rid of inflation during high inflation, the stock market responds extremely positive. It goes up by about 100% in value. And then Lula comes to power, sticks with those reforms. Getting rid of inflation is good for the poor. Brazil was able to lift 20 million people out of poverty over the course of the next two decades and set a foundation for growth. So the key thing is when there are big, what I call tectonic shifts in policy, a clear change in direction, because that's the other key lesson in the book, countries need clarity. And when third world countries shifted, the leadership shifted to a clear change of direction in policy, the markets responded positively to that and set off what I call a self-reinforcing cycle. As stock prices permanently rose, we're seeing right now, it's not clear whether this is a temporary or permanent increase in stock prices in the United States. It's too early to tell because we don't have a lot of clarity in policy right now.
No.
We have, we have expansionary monetary policy, and then we have sequestration, which is, working in the other direction. But when these third world countries indicated a clear change of direction, stock prices went up, the cost of capital for firms went down, so they invested more. And new machines and new technology for workers, and wages actually went up. So there's a win-win here. We can all win.
You write about the policies that the IMF, the World Bank were imposing early on or suggesting companies follow early on, including trying to recreate products in domestic markets rather than import them. It was, I guess it wasn't really an open market, open a free trade kind of policy. Is there evidence that says there are steps to be taken in opening your markets? You talk about financial markets, but overall, is there evidence that says don't throw the doors open right away, be systematic, and be long-term?
Yeah, I think the key lesson really is, as you say, to be long-term. So what do we know? We know that free trade, you mentioned free trade. Free trade is good not because most people think free trade is good because it allows you to export. That's not why free trade is good. Free trade is good because it allows you to consume things that would be very costly for you to produce in isolation. Exporting is what you have to do in order to pay for those goods. And a great example of this is South Korea. So South Korea, during its period of miracle growth from 1965 to 1990, South Korea grows at about 7.1% per year, GDP per capita. It's roughly three times as fast as the United States has ever grown during its fastest period of growth. Post-World War II. Through that entire period, South Korea is running trade deficits. But it's becoming a more prosperous economy because it's not trying to produce everything that it consumes. And also by producing for the world market, it's able to produce a range of goods that the domestic market just couldn't simply support. So South Korea, for instance, was building color televisions for export before there was local color television broadcasting. So that's an example of the ways in which countries can benefit from open markets.
But didn't the IMF and I guess the World Bank, didn't they sometimes say to countries, look, why don't you just grow cotton? You're great at growing cotton. Just grow cotton and everything else will take care of itself if you become an export-oriented economy in that sense. And you'll be able to import the food you need from other places. Is there ever a time when that makes sense, that sort of grand bargain?
Well, I think the IMF and the World Bank have certainly made their share of mistakes over the years. And in many ways, the principal mistake they made, I think I would call it sort of communication in bedside manner, if you will. So one of the critical things that the world needs right now in order to generate even more prosperity is more trust, not only between citizens and their governments, but between emerging market governments and first world governments. And I think an important step in the direction of building more trust would be for the IMF and the World Bank to acknowledge the progress that emerging economies have made and give them a commensurate voice at the table. So, for instance, the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, they account for 21% of global GDP, but only 11.5% of the votes at the IMF and the World Bank. That is not a trust-building or sustainable set of circumstances.
Would that if that happened, would that also mean that policies might change that would be more nuanced?
I think you'd get a set of policies which would reflect a broader range of stakeholders in a more substantive way. I think it would also help to build within the countries, the BRIC countries, but also the developing countries more broadly, a point of view amongst the citizens that, oh, the first world really is serious about recognizing the progress that we've made and all the progress we made as a result of the disciplined policies, the hard steps we took, ironically, as a result of what they've taught us, but that they haven't, the first world has not been willing to accept themselves. I think that would go a long way in helping leaders in emerging markets be able to continue to sell to their populations the need to continue to go down what I call the disciplined road to prosperity. And by the way, if they do that, that will help them to continue to grow, to pull along the slow-growing advanced nations that only grew at 1.3% last year and outright contraction in Europe.
Yeah. How worried are you about that, about the growth of the developed nations going forward?
I'm concerned. I'm concerned, frankly, that we're shooting ourselves in the foot. I don't think that we're settling into underachievement. Right, we know that advanced nations are capable of growing at roughly 2.7%, 2.8% in the United States, something probably closer to 2.12% in Europe. And we're way below that. We're way below that because of our own domestic policies. But our policy stance on the international front also stands to jeopardize the continued and even potentially faster growth of emerging nations.
For example?
So an example would be, look at what we did with trade policy during the financial crisis. At the outset of the crisis, the advanced nations stood up and said, it's really critical that we maintain open trade. But yet, between November 2008 and November 2010, there were more than 800 instances of protectionist policy that were implemented, according to TradeWatch. More than 40% of those implementations were made by advanced nations.
Including the U.S.?
Including the United States. You mentioned cotton earlier. Billions of dollars in cotton subsidies since the start of the last Doha development round, and most of those subsidies, the lion's share of those subsidies have been to farmers in the United States, to the extent that Brazil actually had to sue the United States at the World Trade Organization over its protection of cotton.
What would have been a better action for the U.S. to have taken there, again with this notion, the long-term notion of being stable, clear, but also, you know, maintaining jobs, maintaining an industry?
The long-term view says that we shouldn't be subsidizing cotton if we're not a low-cost producer. We should allow U.S. consumers to buy the world's cheapest cotton. And those billions of dollars we're spending in cotton subsidies could be much more efficiently spent reinvesting in things like education, preparing United States citizens for jobs of the 21st century, rather than trying to save jobs of the past.
You know, When you wrote these third world lessons for first world growth and turnaround, I was wondering, Peter Blair Henry, what about the environmental aspects of this? Where is it all? Are you going to argue that we can do this and be environmentally sound for these nations, or are those nations going to inevitably make poor environmental decisions in order to get competitive advantage?
I'm hopeful, but I think here's the really key point. Emerging nations face a set of trade-offs. We about prosperity and the environment. to a large extent, we ignored those trade-offs in the past, and now we're asking them to make sharper trade-offs than we made. If we want to have a helpful conversation, we need to restart the dialogue. So we need to recognize that that developing countries, their leaders, need to create prosperity. But we also all need to recognize that it's in our collective interest to have a sustainable set of policies with respect to the environment.
Do you hear that?
I don't think we've moved nearly as far as we need to in order to restart that dialogue. And again, the key issues are voice and vote at institutions like the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank. To the extent that we really embrace these nations and give them a seat at the table, I think that we'll be in a much better position to have a more constructive dialogue.
And why don't we, being we the United States in this case, but all the developed nations, why don't we? Is this just all about holding on to power?
I think it's hard to be humble. I think we're used to teaching, and I think it's gonna take some time. But I'm hopeful that we'll recognize, hey, there actually is a lot that we can learn. I've mentioned everything from discipline in the context of fiscal policy, discipline in the context of free trade, and we haven't talked very much about debt issues. But at the heart of Europe is too much debt, and that's a lesson that we should have learned. Everywhere from the third world crisis in 1982 to the Mexican and the Asian crises of the 1990s. So there are a lot of lessons that if we're just humble enough and can look back and really take those lessons to heart, I think we can have a more hopeful future.
Well, we did take the lessons. We now monetize our debt just the way the third world nations were doing it for a while, right?
Well, we're not doing it to the same extent.
No, Peter Blair-Henry is Dean of New York University Stern School of Business, author of Turnaround, Third World Lessons for First World Growth. He's speaking at Town Hall tonight at 7:30, talk about some of these issues. You can find out more by going to our webpage, kuow.org. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
In a minute here, several green thumbs join us with organic gardening advice. What to grow, where to plant it, what to do with your garden's bounty. That's right around the corner.
Support for KUOW comes from Compost Days, celebrating the Northwest's accomplishments in composting food and yard waste. Now through April 15th, compost purchasing information and details about The Big Dig are available online at compostdays.com.
45 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. Forecast says rain expected this afternoon with a high today of 50. Overnight, breezy and rainy, a low of 45. Tomorrow, windy with showers, chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon, and a high of 50.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Repertory Theater, presenting Good People, a comedy of class and culture. Life is hard in South Boston, and Margie is out of luck. An encounter with her high school sweetheart leaves Margie wondering if life is about choice or chance. Playing March 8th through the 31st. Tickets at seattlerep.org.
10:42. 10 years after the beginning of the Iraq War, what might the future hold for Iraq? We'll hear some informed thoughts on that in 30 minutes.
Now get your entrenching tools. It's time to garden. I need a sound after that. I don't know what it is, but I just need a sound after that.
A shovel sinking into soil.
Marty Wingate writes about garden and traveling. She writes at martywingate.com. Her book is Landscaping for Privacy, among her books. Good to see you.
Hello.
Greg Rayburn, Vashon Basin Steward, works on habitat restoration, salmon recovery on Vashon and Maury Island. And in that, working on salmon recovery, of course, that's helped sustain the soil. And build the soil.
Sure.
Sure, why not? Because I'm going back to when, you know, the rivers flood, the salmon's fan out, the bears come, take the salmon back in the forest. That happens on Vashon all the time, right?
No, the raccoons do a pretty good job, though.
Do the raccoons do what the bears used to do? I mean, they grab the salmon and kind of haul it back into the forest?
Yeah, they'll pull them right. They'll go into the streams and pull them right out and drag them into the woods.
That, sir, would be an interesting study.
Yeah. And some of those raccoons are almost approaching bear cub size.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they are. And Lisa Taylor is Children's Education Program Manager at Seattle Tilth and also a gardener at Seattle Tilth.
Yeah.
It's good to see you.
Nice to see you.
What's happening in your vegetable garden right there at Seattle Tilth? Right
well, now? We are just coming back to life. So a few things are overwintering. So we've been checking out the little carrots that are getting bigger and bigger. Waiting, decided to wait to pull them all and let them get bigger.
Oh, that's so hard to do because
it is.
You see that green and you think, oh boy, carrots, and you pull it up and it's thinner than a pencil.
Well, these are pretty good. We planted them last August, so we overwintered these, and they're decent size. But the folks at the Garden Hotline and over at Seattle Youth Garden Works, I consulted my colleagues, and they thought we had a month, and that they would fatten up a little bit before they bolt and make flowers.
What's your kale doing?
You have kale
that you overwintered there?
I have. I have kale that's been that grew all last season and lasted through the winter.
Ah.
And it is bolting, so it's starting to make flowers. The stuff that overwintered is still like this. It's very small, very small. And I am guarding it from all the slugs. I use a combination of magic and prayer and copper sheeting.
Yeah, I wonder which works.
I think it's a triple. It's a triple whammy. Yeah.
Do you eat kale flowers?
I do. I was telling Marcy that when when those things bolt as they will this spring, the ones that lasted through the winter, the flowers are delicious.
Huh? That's
yeah,
great.
They taste like, the collards are my favorite. They taste like honey dipped broccoli. It is true.
Really?
It is true.
So honey dipped broccoli.
Honey dipped
without
broccoli.
Honey dipping them.
Without broccoli and without honey.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
All right, have you got some questions for these folks as we did somebody say spring is starting in a couple of days? I think that's crazy.
No, it's Wednesday.
How dare Michael Fagan say that word?
On Wednesday, we having snow on Wednesday?
Could be. Convergence zone.
Maybe about the third year in a row that
it's just falling right there.
Yeah.
I planted my sweet peas, but I was not crazy enough to plant them out in the garden. I soaked them overnight in some water because sweet peas have hard seed coats, and I wanted to loosen so that a little seed would burst the seed coat. Then I planted them in two shallow pots, put them on the back porch, which is protected and sunny, and then secured hardwire cloth over them so the squirrels wouldn't think, oh, wait a minute, did I bury something there? And so they are going to be coming up in a couple of weeks, snow or no snow.
Why don't you don't your sweet peas overwinter?
If I would leave them alone and let them go to seed sweet peas or plant sweet peas in the fall, a lot of people do that, and they will come up and they will sort of sit there all mm-hmm. winter long, and then they will start growing. But I haven't done that. I usually don't let them go to seed because I want them to flower longer. And I have not planted them in the fall before, but that's something I could do.
Bob Lilly said if you plant them late fall, just enough time to mm-hmm. germinate and come up and be a couple of inches tall.
You mean like
plants
October?
Themselves? Yeah, like September. Huh. The plants themselves will be two or three times as large, so
yes.
you might have longer stems and stuff for
yeah.
cutting.
Yeah.
So I tried that this year.
And you
I planted them a little early. It was a little warm. So they're actually kind of big, but they withstood all so far. Little bit of frost damage, but the plant themselves look like they're going to start growing again.
Our number is 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. If you have any questions for our panelists, you can also go to weekday@kuow.org and send us an email, or the KUOW Green Days page and post some stuff there that we will read. What are you? What were you working on this week, sir?
Oh, I was.
If anything, I know you're mostly working.
Yeah, but I did get out in the garden a bit and pulled some weeds. But in addition to that, I was noticing the salmon berries coming on now, and the trilliums are coming up and starting to bloom as well. So that's, to me, always feels like spring.
Yay!
You there on the Vashon?
Mm-hmm.
You have lots of frogs.
Oh, I heard those frogs.
What do they like to do? What do they like to eat?
Besides
where do they
noise?
Like to live? Yeah. Yeah, besides make noise.
Well, one of my favorite wildlife moments I've ever witnessed was one of those little tiny Pacific chorus frogs sitting there it was actually on the meter box on the side of a house. And along came, and I was only a couple feet from it, and it was eating flying termites, which are huge. I mean, they're as long as this little Pacific chorus frog. And the chorus frog would just pounce on them, snatch them out of the air, leap up in the air, grab them, eat one. Then as soon as that one was down, boom, jumped up, ate another one.
That's excellent. Mm. They were protecting the house.
They were. They were. Wow. They were little guardians. So termite problems, bring on the chorus frogs.
Oh. All right. Here's a couple of questions from the KOW Green Days page. And I'm not sure if I understand this first question, but maybe you guys do. Are bulbs made the same way seeds are?
Do bulbs develop the same way seeds? Bulbs don't – seeds are developed when a flower is pollinated. But bulbs divide. So a tulip bulb, if you have a tulip bulb or a daffodil bulb in the ground, after a year or two, if you dig it up, you'll see that the original bulb may or may not be there, but little bulb offsets will exist. So that's dividing underground. That's different from a flower being pollinated.
I see.
Is that the question, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's the question. Okay. And a fine answer.
That seems good.
All right, Aaron's in.
Oh,
were you going to add to that?
No, there was another Facebook question that I could tackle when we're done with
it. Which one's that one? Does the anyone want free orchard mason bees?
No, the Impatiens one.
Oh, I don't see that one.
Because I checked with our noxious weed
folks. Yeah, downy mildew. Uh-oh.
No.
Impatiens?
Yeah. There was a person had found, had 30-year-old Impatiens balsamina seeds
that
they had
got. Don't plant them. Don't plant them.
Seen in a glass, a glass container.
Yeah.
Don't.
Well, they're 30 years old. And so I talked to our noxious weeds folks, because there is an Impatiens glandulifera that is a noxious weed. And I wasn't sure if this one's relative or if they've had issues with it. So, and they said, no, they weren't familiar with that one as much. But they said it's probably pretty unlikely that the Impatiens seeds will still be viable because they're not a long-lived seed to start with.
Why were you saying don't plant them, don't plant them?
Oh, I was probably thinking of that weed. There's one Impatiens that grows very tall. And I'm not sure which
that's
species
the glandular.
It is. Yeah, and when the seeds are ripe, they explode into the air and go really far out, and that's how the plant is dispersed.
Glandula?
Glandulifera. It's policeman's helmet.
Yeah.
Oh.
Policeman's helmet.
Oh, I know that one.
Yeah.
Is that here?
Yeah.
As an noxious weed?
It's a popular trade at garden clubs because it's – everybody easy. Gets so much, and it's so easy to grow.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool looking.
But we don't like them.
No, it's noxious weed.
All right. Aaron's on Mount Baker. Hi, Aaron. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is so exciting for me.
Great. You're thinking about lawns?
Yeah. Well, I have a side yard that it gets the soil just gets so wet throughout the winter and the spring that we have a hard time growing grass there because it can't – when we moved in, it was all gravel, so we had to take the gravel up and plant new lawn. And we've never – it's never been able to take, like, a strong enough hold because it gets washed away by the rain.
Now you know why there was gravel there.
I was going to suggest
that. Well, yeah, that answered that question for us. But I've thought that we may be able to, like, introduce a moss that might grow there really well. And I've seen, you know, a lot of lawns, particularly in Mount Baker, we seem to have a lot of lawns that have a really thick moss that help fill it out. And I was wondering if you could recommend... if that seemed like a feasible idea, and if you could recommend some moss that would grow really well.
Is there any moss currently growing there?
Well, there's not, but it's a really protected, there's a big hedge on one side and a tall fence, and I've just have my non-gardener mind thought, well, maybe it's just never been introduced.
Usually it introduces itself.
Yeah,
well, I sort of figure.
And that's where
I could help it.
And that's where I'm not really up on my moss species, but I can't. A popular way of propagating moss is to take fine moss in an area and then blend it with some buttermilk and then pour it onto whatever surface you're pouring it onto. So that's how people make, like, moss-covered rocks. So you can try the same technique, find some mosses you like, and then mix them up with some milk, buttermilk, and then blend them in the same blender you make your margaritas in, and then
okay,
go out and
blend them.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
And then just chop them up and then spread them out and then let them go. The hardest part with maintaining moss is that it isn't really that low a maintenance if you're trying to keep it solid moss. If you go to a lot of the Japanese style gardens where they have expansive moss, you'll see very patient gardeners out there pulling up grass blades because they do
at the Bloedel Reserve. Their moss garden is the highest maintenance part of the garden.
Is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Depending on what your standards are, you can also just set your mower at elevation just above the moss and just keep the grass cut at that height as well.
It's fun. It's fun to try it. Anyways, Aaron, thanks a lot. Thanks for calling, Aaron. We're talking with our gardeners, Lisa Taylor, Greg Rayburn, Marty Wingate.
Hey, Steve.
Witt is on Bacon Hill. Yes, Beacon, I'm going to call it Bacon Hill. Beacon Hill. Yes,
Beacon Hill.
Go ahead first.
I got to tell you, I wrote this book a couple years ago, Your Farm in
Hold
the
that
City.
Book up. Somebody took that book from me the other day.
Oh, well, I can give this one to you.
No, I'm saying they said, I need that book because this is a great book. It is a really great book.
Well, thank you. I'm going to be at Costco on Saturday signing books and talking to folks.
Pallets?
We're going to have, you got to climb the stairs and, yeah. No, I think we'll have a lot of copies there and we're excited that Costco's going
to be. On 4th Avenue South.
Yeah, the downtown Costco on 4th Avenue South from 1 to 3 Saturday.
Here's the kind of questions you're going to get when you talk about the farm in the city. Witt's on Beacon Hill. Hi, Witt. Witt, you there?
Oh, hi. Yeah, sorry. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I had my fiance and I had made her a raised vegetable garden, and we used it for a season, and she loved it, but the neighborhood cat was pooping it a little bit.
Yeah.
Using it as a litter box. Mm-hmm. And now she refuses to use it again unless I take out all of the dirt that I had purchased and buy her new dirt for it. So I'm concerned about toxoplasmosis and
sure.
E. coli, and we're wondering how we can safely grow vegetables in there, and I'm hoping not to replace the dirt.
Right. Yeah, that's
Farm in the City, vegetable garden produced by cats.
Cat thing going on. I think you're mostly in danger if you're pregnant or nursing or a child for the toxoplasmosis. So probably adults that don't fit into that category have less. It's less of a risk. When that's happened to me, because I have this nice fluffy bed and lots of cats cruise through my yard, I've used the cat scooper to get out the solid pieces. And then what I did was I just tried not to grow things that were edible there. I grew flowers and things there. Keeping the soil wet, keeping it more compact, making it less attractive as a litter box is going to help you. So there might be some excavation without any deposits too. So, taking a look to see really what's gone on over there. I actually have gotten around the cat thing by keeping my beds covered until the plants fill out with a hoop covered with Remay or lightweight slitted plastic. So I get, a little bit of heat. I get some protection. I can cover them all the way around at the ends and the sides, and I don't have to worry about venting. So bad side is my plants are out of sight, but I have to just remember to peek underneath. But as soon as the things flush out and I keep the soil real moist, I've heard all kinds of crazy ideas, though. If you really get frustrated, you could try the bamboo skewer thing, poking bamboo skewers point side up all through your beds, and that might be a good deterrent.
Poking yourself in the hand.
I thought you were going to say.
What, chicken wire, wadded up. Cats just don't want uneven surfaces to walk
yeah,
on.
Yeah, and real wet, they won't like it there. Give them, and the other thing is to give them a place that they do like, an attractive place in the under the ornamental beds or in under the roadies, so that the cats have a place and you have a place.
All right, here's one more on that before we're done. Vicky's
right.
In Woodinville. Hi, Vicky.
Hello.
You're looking at voles, huh?
Yeah, I had a raised bed, and the voles have, actually the moles came through my entire yard, and then the voles decided to use all of the runs, and now they're really concentrated in my raised garden area. And I don't know, I could set traps, but that's, pretty
All right, I'm gonna let Greg answer this because I'm out of time already.
But. All right, yeah, I had voles take all the roots off one of my containerized apple trees this year. Just turned it into a toothpick. Amazing whittling. But one thing you can do when you install beds is to put hardware cloth underneath it, and that creates a barrier against any of the above from digging up, because they generally won't crawl up the side and then drop in from above. They're tunneling in from underneath.
And then, of course, the other thing is that you're part of the natural ecosystem, and they're your wildlife. They're
and
like
always
the elephants.
Plant extra.
Plant extra for the animals. Yep. All right, Greg Rayburn, Lisa Taylor, Marty Wingate, and Lisa, you'll be at Costco.
Downtown.
You mean anywhere?
Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Oh, have a good time there.
April 6th in Issaquah.
All right. Just regularly?
No, Northwest Natives presentation.
All right, good.
Best plants for sun and shade.
All right, good. We'll know more about that. We'll post some of that on the weekday KUW Green Days page. Thank you all. This is Weekday.
#10:59. In the news today, 7 Marines killed in a training accident in Nevada. Our full report in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Center for Spiritual Living on Sandpoint Way, offering a modern way of celebrating Easter on Sunday.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.